Give me a background on how you grew up on a farm in Michigan and how you ended up in New York today.
Well, that's a long story. Have you got all day? Let me see if I can do the short version of it. I went to Kalamazoo College, which is one of those life-changing schools. And I always wanted to be a writer, but I wasn't quite sure how. So from Kalamazoo, I went into grad school in English, actually, at Princeton. And I kind of, you know, enjoyed that, but didn't want to be an academic. So I left academia after finishing my PhD and began working at as a copywriter in a corporate identity consulting firm, which is basically people who name and help people design their brands for things. And that was kind of fascinating. And I did that for a number of years, during which I wrote my first book, which was a novel. And of
Flight.
Course, I was living
yes,
in New York
I remember
at the time.
That. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So then I kind of switched to nonfiction, and 3 books later, here I am.
Nonfiction. It seems like you said, Flight was your first book was fiction, but then you've got 3 narrative nonfiction books. So is that the niche that you're comfortable with?
I like that niche. I like calling it narrative nonfiction. Yeah, because I, you know, I aim to still think in terms of, you know, in the terms that novelists think in, like character and plot. What's the trajectory of this book? How do the characters change and develop? You know, and of course, it's interesting to me to have to figure that out while adhering to the true story. And not every story will work for this kind of book. But yeah, I just found that I enjoyed writing nonfiction a lot more. I kind of like that sense of limitation.
So today we're talking about The Brothers Vonnegut, your newest book, Science and Fiction in the House of Magic. What sparked your interest in The Brothers Vonnegut?
Well, it's interesting. Most people assume that I came to this book as a fan of Kurt Vonnegut, but actually I came to the book when I found out about Bernard Vonnegut. I was reading a history of New York City's hydro infrastructure, which is something that fascinates me, and I discovered this little-known incident in 1950 where New York City cloud-seeded the Catskill Mountains about 100 miles north of the city in an attempt to make rain for their reservoirs. It was it had been a dry couple of years, and New York was actually running out of water. And they cloud-seeded the Catskills, and an incredibly wet summer resulted, and then a wet fall, and eventually they cloud-seeded during the winter storm over Thanksgiving 1950, and huge floods ensued, and the city was actually slapped with a big stack of lawsuits. And so, you know, they abandoned municipal rainmaking. And when I heard that Bernard Vonnegut had invented the process by which the Catskills were cloud seeded and that he was the older brother of Kurt Vonnegut, I just got fascinated with this other brother and started looking into him. And the more I looked into it, the better it got, because it turned out, of course, that the two of them were working side by side at GE in Schenectady during this period. And Kurt's early work was very much based on his brother's actual experiments.
Yeah, that's interesting. Most of us, I think, didn't realize that initially, at least, Bernie was the famous brother, not Kurt.
Yes, he was considered the Vonnegut family success story, and Kurt was kind of the Vonnegut family screw up a little bit. You know, he had dropped out of Cornell because he wasn't really interested in biochemistry, which is what he had been told he should major in. And he'd kind of, you know, then gone to the war and then come back and gone to Chicago and tried to finish up his degree. But when he had his first son, he actually decided he needed to get a stable job and support his family. And that's when Bernard recommended him for a job at GE.
Talk to me about the relationship between these two brothers. There seems to have been, you know, just normal sibling rivalry in the beginning, but they seem to really have their lives and their work intertwined, and both of them are handling some ethical, moral dilemmas.
Yeah. I mean, that for me was the interesting story that kind of emerged for me as I went into the archives of both brothers and saw how much, you know. And certainly they were. Bernard was 8 years older than Kurt. He was always the A student, always the scientific genius. He was the one who was going to make his mark on the world. And Kurt very much saw it that way. Kurt was kind of the class clown, the kid who, you know, spent too much time writing newspaper articles in college and not focusing on his tests and exams. And he always was in awe of his older brother and a little bit competitive with him. But during the time that they were both at GE, I think they really did grow closer together, and they really began to kind of exchange ideas and talk about the ethical dilemmas that Bernard, as a scientist, was facing. Because, of course, this is the era right after, you know, the development of the nuclear bomb and Hiroshima, and there was a lot of talk about scientists and their inventions and how responsible are scientists for the use that's made of their inventions. Mm-hmm. And Bernard, who had invented cloud seeding, began to see his invention taken up by the military, used as a weapon, or attempted to be used as a weapon. At least they were thinking about it that way. And he started to worry, you know, well, what can I do if I don't want my work to be turned into something that does harm?
So in writing about this, you know, maybe this is a bit of a tangent, but what do you think about how humans constantly seem to want to control nature?
You know, that's a good question, because I think that in a way that's underneath, that's the question that's underneath all of this and that drives a lot of my work, is this funny impulse that we have to control nature. And certainly, you know, this, in this particular period, the period right after the bomb, it was thought that, you know, we were on the verge of just taking full control of everything. You know, we had figured out the most fundamental force in the universe and, you know, used it to end a world war. And now, you know, the possibilities of science seemed infinite. And human beings, of course, would look at that and say, well, what's the first thing we want to do? We want to, you know, make it not rain when we have picnics planned. Make it not snow in cities. Make it rain in the desert instead. I think there's this constant urge that humans have to control the environment around them. And to me, that's one of the most fascinating kind of subtexts of all this stuff.
Fascinating and scary. I think Mother Nature probably always has the last word.
Yeah, certainly. Weather, you know, as it turned out, was not strictly controllable. But the scientists who did this weather work were really laying the foundation for modern climate science, where we think about what kinds of inadvertent consequences might human beings have on the climate.
And Kurt, although we think of him as a literary figure, he actually knew a lot about science too, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. And that's a good point, and it's something that I wanted to bring out in the book. I think a lot of people think of Kurt Vonnegut as this wacky, out there, sci-fi-ish, fantasist kind of writer, which was always baffling to Kurt because he himself thought that he was just writing straight-up social satire. And when he was asked later in life why he had chosen to write science fiction, he said there was no helping it because General Electric was science fiction.
Mm.
And he really, you know, he did have the science background. That's why he got the job as a publicity guy at GE. He understood the science. He could go in and look at new inventions and kind of write about them in an intelligent way. He always had that understanding of science, you know, that a lot of writer types don't necessarily have.
So Kurt's writing these funky press releases for GE. Is that how that works? And how does that lead to creative writing in a literary way?
Well, it was an interesting thing to trace. He is the perfect company man by day. He's working in the PR department, cranking out peppy press releases, you know, about GE's latest invention. And by night and on weekends, he would go home and write short stories. And at first, he was just kind of writing the sort of schlocky short stories that he thought that the slick magazines wanted, magazines like Collier's and the Saturday Evening Post that published a lot of fiction in those days. And fiction, of course, was entertainment. So he was writing, you know, romance stories, little meet-cute at the bus stop, things like that. And And he was just, it wasn't really working. He wasn't good enough. Mm. And he didn't have a unique enough voice yet. And the point at which he found that voice was the point at which he started actually writing about the things he was seeing going on at GE and the things that he was seeing his brother grapple with.
So what did his brother Bernard think about his writing?
Bernard was a big fan of his brother's writing. Bernard received copies of every one of Kurt's novels before they came out and avidly read them. He was, you know, actually, sometimes Kurt would give him, you know, Kurt did a couple of things later on in his career. He gave a speech to the Association of, or the American Physical Society. He gave a commencement address at MIT. And he would show these things to Bernie first and get Bernie's approval. And Bernie very much shared Kurt's humanist concerns about what was going on in science.
Almost sounds like they're one person complimenting the other.
Yeah, and that's kind of why I liked the story so much, because it's a story about these two brothers who are very different people, but it's also kind of a story about science and the arts and the way they interact.
And you just had an article come out in New Yorker magazine, about the role that Jane, Kurt's wife, plays in especially Kurt's literary career.
Yes, yeah, that was one of the surprises that I kind of came across when I was researching the book. I was given access to some letters from Kurt to Jane, actually about 130 letters, that just revealed how intently she had helped to convince him to really, you know, take himself seriously as a writer and really try to do it as a career. Because at first he was all, you know, convinced that, no, Bernie's the smart one in the family. I'm not, you don't understand. I'm not very smart. I'm not that good. And she just kept saying, you know, you are, and you can do it. And I think, you know, this is not an uncommon story, the story of the, you know, the wife behind the great man. But it was really fun just to see it unfold so clearly.
Everyone needs a muse and a cheerleader, I suppose.
Yeah. And there were certainly, I mean, Kurt did not have an easy time becoming a writer. He had to learn to write, and then he had to break through. And anyone who has tried to write knows how hard both of those things are in different ways. And he worked like a dog at both of them. And so having her there as his, you know, support and having someone who really believed in him the whole time, I'm absolutely convinced that he couldn't have done it without her.
And yet they ended up in a divorce, sadly.
Yep, sadly. So it goes.
But from what I read in your article, at the end there, when Jane was near death, they still had a good relationship.
Yeah, I believe that, you know, I mean, when people share as much as they shared and are as, you know, as much a unit as they were a unit for so long, they don't ever really lose that, even though circumstances take them apart.
And your research, you must have done intense research for this kind of a project, for any nonfiction project. Were there any surprises? Talk a little bit about that research journey, what you did, and I believe you contacted Vonnegut family members as well.
Yes, the Vonnegut family was helpful, and they are wonderful, warm, generous people who have to deal with the difficulty of sharing, you know, their family with the world. Kurt is such an icon now. I can't imagine how hard that must be. But I spent most of my time in archives. Both Bernard's papers are at the University at Albany in New York, and they were incredibly revealing. You know, reading the scientist's notebook, I could literally track him hour by hour, you know, doing his experiments, when he gets excited, when he's worried, what fails, what doesn't. You know, it was quite gripping. And then Kurt, of course, his early papers, letters and manuscripts and things are at the Lilly Library in Bloomington, Indiana. And so there I could kind of trace his successes and failures, you know, his stories being rejected here and being rejected there, and he rewrites it and tries again and gets some response and rewrites it and tries again. So it was really, you know, I had to construct timelines for both brothers and put them, you know, map them out onto a, a plot of dates and kind of see what's going on when.
Any surprises, something that you really didn't expect that you came across?
Well, you know, for me, the whole story was surprising, just really seeing the parallels between them, seeing, you know, Kurt writing a press release about ultrasonics and then, you know, going home that night and starting a story about a radio sound that makes people bliss out. You know, it's just seeing the actual connections. At one point, I came across Bernard's description of his own invention, silver iodide cloud seeding, and the way he described it was a new way for ice crystals to stack or lock like cannonballs on a courthouse lawn. And that's exactly how Kurt Vonnegut describes Ice 9, the dangerous form of ice that's solid at room temperature, in his breakthrough book, Cat's Cradle.
So what have we done with that scientific discovery today? Where is that type of weather control today?
Well, you know, weather control never delivered the kind of sweeping control of weather that many people hoped it would in the late 1940s. You know, the newspapers all responded to GE's news that their scientists could make rain with predictions of, you know, well, now we'll never have to be bothered by the weather again. Now the deserts will bloom and the crops will never be ruined by hailstorms. And everyone was very excited. And of course, it didn't quite turn out that way because the weather is such a huge and complex and difficult system that, you know, even being able to observe it all is impossible in terms of the amount of data involved. And some people understood this from the beginning. You know, the weather is, today we call it chaotic. It's, you know, there's a whole school of, a whole theory, chaos theory, that helps describe things like weather that are just huge unstable systems, difficult to control. Cloud seeding does work. Bernard's method of seeding clouds with silver iodide is still widely used. You know, in the West, there's kind of a revival of interest in it now because of the serious drought and because of the number of metropolises and places that depend on, say, the snowpack in the Sierra Nevada. The thing is, you can't make rain from a blue sky. You know, you can't summon up clouds. All you can do is really improve the production of rain from rain clouds that already exist. And even that's not extreme. There was a study recently done in Wyoming that suggests that, and this was a National Science Foundation-funded study that suggests that with clouds, you know, with winter storm fronts that are coming in over mountains, you can increase the yield, the precipitation yield, somewhere between 5 and 15%.
Mm.
So, you know, that's not going to solve the problem of drought in the West, but it does add something significant to the snowpack.
One can't help thinking about, and I believe you alluded to that in your work as well, the butterfly wings. You know, if they move in one place, they're going to affect things on the other side of the globe.
Yep. It's a big system, and there are a lot of consequences that expand rapidly from small things.
So thank you for talking with me about the Brothers Vonnegut, Science and Fiction in the House of Magic. Appreciate your time, Ginger.
Thank you for having me.